Hello and welcome to the Ringer MLB show. My name is Ben Lindberg, and I'm a staff writer for TheRinger.com, joined as always by Michael Bauman, my fellow writer for The Ringer. Hello, Michael.
Yo!
We are both very sleep deprived. There was a baseball game last night, and it lasted a long time, and it didn't end very long ago, and we are going to try to talk about it. And it was, I think you could make a case that aside from games that kind of crossed over into larger sociocultural importance, you know, whether it's Jackie Robinson's debut or post-September 11th games, just purely for baseball reasons, I think you could make a case that last night, if not the best game on its own, was maybe the greatest game, just in the sense of how high the stakes were, how high the anticipation level was, and how well it delivered on that.
Yeah, I have been struggling to put this on any sort of list, but it's, you know, I don't know how you can say that in baseball terms it wasn't that big.
No, it rose to the moment in every way,
which I was worried about, because it looked like once Kluber started getting hit, I was, you know, did the sad open the Word document in the fourth inning to get a jump on writing.
Yeah, right. And I was sort of down on this series heading into the game. I thought
I feel like you need to answer for this, because all week you've been dogging it. Is anything interesting going to happen?
Maybe it's just because I had to write the game stories for games 1 and 2, which were probably the worst.
Yeah, and game 2 is a dragon in particular.
Yeah. And I thought that the series was kind of getting carried by the matchup and the storylines heading into the series, which were great and really were enough to carry a series. But I didn't think that the individual games had really matched the built-in hype. But once we got to game 7...
Yeah, it all happened at once.
Yeah. So we're just going to spend this whole episode talking about that game, essentially. So later on in the episode, Michael and I are just going to do a draft. We're just going to shout out some of our favorite things from that game. We were planning to do a draft of our favorite things from the playoffs as a whole, but that game just had too many things within its 10 innings not to just do a draft of that game itself. And I think that there were some things that happened there that were kind of emblematic of this postseason as a whole, or maybe went against what we've seen this entire postseason. So I think that'll be fun. But first, we are just going to get a dose of pure uncut Cubs adrenaline from our colleague at The Ringer, Robert Mays, who is a Cubs fan and has probably slept even less than we have. It is very early. It's been, I don't know, about 6 hours or so since the Cubs won the World Series, which is still a strange thing to say. So theoretically, at least, Mays's blood alcohol content could still be elevated at this point. Is it?
It is not. I actually, now you get the overhead chat at O'Hare right now, which is where I am. It is not elevated. I wrote yesterday, so I kept myself at a pretty decent one beer per one glass of water clip, which was mandated by the Ringer staff in LA, knowing I was coming today. So I abided by that. I felt really good this morning after my hour and a half sleep, but about as good as I could feel.
So how long until you think, you know, we talk about, you know, how long it would take New York to be habitable after a nuclear attack or something like that. So how long until you think Wrigleyville is safe for human habitation again?
It's going to take a while. I saw on the standard that someone was carrying an electric pole down the street. I didn't see that, but I did almost get trampled to death. I haven't had that feeling since I saw Rage Against the Machine live. So the fact that we can compare those two things probably tells you all you need to know about the atmosphere there. There were just like clothes like strewn about in the streets and just trampled over. It was absolutely ridiculous, but I think that overall people were a little bit more contained than I thought they might be.
So where were you? Set this up when you watched all this happen.
So I was at my friend Jason's house. He's my best friend of, I don't know, a decade and a half. There were about 30 of us there all packed in. It was pretty great in terms of a group of people to watch it with. I was supposed to go to LA yesterday for some Ringer stuff and talked to everybody, and I was like, guys, sorry. There's no way I could do that. So we were all there, and after they won, we all kind of celebrated for a little while. I definitely cried. And then we'd all just piled onto Clark Street. I mean, he lives about a block away from the stadium and a block away from all the madness. So we all filtered out, and the madness did not take very long to begin. I mean, it, already people were just filling the streets. I actually just barely got onto Clark before they closed it down the first time. So, yeah, we were in the thick of it, and that's really all I would have wanted in that moment.
I hate to ask the standard sideline reporter type questions, but I don't know where else to go right now. So how did it feel? What was running through your head?
As soon as the ball hit down into the ground and I saw Brad was going to get it, I just like put my head in my hands. I mean, I thought about my dad a lot. And then just everyone that was there were the people I watched the Cubs with all season. You know, one of my friends is the guy I took to game 6 of the NLCS. Everyone that I went with to the first game of the NLCS that we went to, I think it was game 2, they were all there. I mean, it's just the group of people that I was with is the exact group of people I would have wanted to be with. And that made it special. I mean, it was an incredible 7 months. I mean, from start to finish, I knew it was going to be fun. And I tried to throw myself into it as much as I possibly could. And the way that it ended last night, I just don't think it could have ended any better.
Yeah. And are you a fatalistic Cubs fan? Were you going into that game convinced they were going to find a way to blow it? Or what was your lowest point in that game?
The Davis homer was definitely my lowest point. But that Kipnis ball that he ripped foul in the bottom of the ninth, I believe. I thought that was gone.
Yeah.
When it left
everybody,
that, I thought it was out.
Yeah.
And that was, I said it's gone as soon as he hit it. And when it drifted foul, the feeling in that moment, I can't even describe to you. It was just more relief than I think is humanly possible. But that was it. I mean, I thought in that moment it was done. So outside of the Davis homer, that was easily the point where it was just like, oh, I cannot believe this is happening.
So I ran into you in the stands before game 4. So, you know, I haven't talked to you since then. What was watching that, you know, even though it turned out to be a loss, you know, watching a World Series game live at Wrigley, what was that like?
It was tough, but I mean, just being there was incredible. And being there with my brother was really special. And he and I hadn't gone to a game this year. His work schedule really didn't allow him to and everything else. I've been to so many. And the fact that it was me and him at a World Series game in Wrigley Field, that I always will appreciate, even though they didn't win. But the fact that I was at a World Series game the year the Cubs did win the World Series, I think I'll remember it that way a long time from now. I won't remember how solemn I felt afterward. You know, I stumbled back into that same buddy's apartment, and everyone had been sad drinking for the last, like, hour or so. And I just looked around, I was like, I can't be here anymore. Like, I have to go home. Me and my brother went home and watched Dumb and Dumber on TV and fell asleep by midnight. It's just not the night I expected, but looking back on it now, I'm really, really glad I was there.
And did it matter how the drought got broken? I mean, would you have cared if, you know, the team had been an 85 win, you know, wild card winner that just barely scraped by? And does it matter that the Cubs were actually the best team in baseball and won the most games and were just a juggernaut all year? Do you care? Does it matter? Does it make this more satisfying?
It makes it a little more satisfying only because I was in it from the beginning this year. You know, it's not something where I felt like it picked up steam at the end. My first game was the day of the NFL draft. It was freezing cold. The game before had been rained out and Arrieta was pitching. I went across the street and bought a sweater and caught 5 innings before I had to go cover the draft. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's how early it was. It was so cold that I couldn't just wear normal clothes. And getting to be with this team for that amount of time and really being locked in from the beginning, that's what made it special. You know, Addison Russell hitting that home run against Cincinnati in the home opener. I remember that. You know, Javi Baez hitting one to have a walk-off when he was wearing those pink shoes in the beginning of May. You know, I remember when Zobrist was 0 for whatever to start it and then went on that tear. So I think that's what makes it special. The fact that it was the ups and downs and the swings of an entire baseball season and really getting to feel every single bit of that. That's why I liked it. If they had won 10 less games or whatever, it would have been fine. But really in understanding that it was worth being around every single moment for this team, that's why I enjoyed it so much.
Was there a part of you that, you know, you're a fairly rational person as far as I know, but was there a part of you that thought like this couldn't happen for some reason, like that the curse was real just because it hadn't happened for 108 years?
No, I mean, I didn't think that. I just think that baseball sucks in the sense that you can have the best team by far, and it doesn't matter in the end. I mean, if you have just a team that trades for whoever Andrew Miller is, the god of pitching, and then you have Kluber just being totally locked in, you can beat a team that's better than you. And that was the thing that was hard for me to understand, just not being around baseball for a while. You know, I went away for a while, and I've admitted that more than once. And kind of being back in this setting and understanding that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that you win 103 games or you have the best run differential in 15 years or whatever. In this moment, none of that has any consequence. So coming to terms with that was difficult. But outside of that, no, there was nothing cosmic at play in my mind.
Yeah. And so you were sort of a lapsed baseball fan, and you got seduced by another sport that you sometimes write and talk about. And now you're back in. Do you think that you will stay in, or is it like mission accomplished and now you can move on?
I'll go keep watching this team. I just like watching these Cubs teams. Mm-hmm. I mean, I enjoy watching Chris Bryant and Javi Baez and Anthony Rizzo play baseball. So, I mean, I think that it'd be really fun to try to do it again next year. I mean, with a bunch of the same guys back, and Godspeed Dexter Fowler, I hope he gets paid $100 million. But this group is enjoyable, and I feel like that's what's going to bring me back more than anything else.
Do you have a guy, like, you know, watching all year? Is there somebody that you've latched onto particularly?
Javi's been my favorite. I mean, even since the beginning, it was fun to kind of see the rest of the world come to grips with how entertaining he is, and in good ways and bad. I mean, yesterday was kind of head-scratching with some of the plays he made early, but he's going to come back. You know, he's that guy that the highs are going to be high and the lows are going to be low. And just in the moment, there were so many plays he made this year that were just fun, that just made watching those games and being at those games fun. And that's why just it's hard not to be, you know, latch onto him. It's hard not to gravitate toward him. But Chris Bryant's also pretty good.
It's a great aside.
It doesn't matter much now, but in real time, what were you thinking about the way Joe Maddon was managing the game?
I was not thrilled at all. I really didn't like it. I didn't like it when Hendricks came out. I didn't like it when Lester came out.
Yeah.
I didn't like it in game six when Chapman was in with a 5-run lead to get three innings worth of outs.
Yeah.
I didn't enjoy anything that happened over the last two games, but like you said, it doesn't matter now. I mean, now it has absolutely no hold on anything that just happened. And but if it had, I would have been very, very upset.
And what is it like to watch this game with you? Intense person?
I'm apoplectic. I sit there very quietly until something happens, and then there's a lot of screaming. But for the most part, it's very, very quiet and just intense. I mean, there was a lot of, like, hunched over. There's a lot of pulled up into, like, a semi-fetal position in the corner of the couch. I am not a fun person. I guarantee you I was not a fun person to be around last night.
And what was your favorite quality of this team, just about the way it played in general?
I mean, there was never a moment in any single game where I thought they were done. I mean, that Giants game, I think that'll always be my favorite one from this season outside of what happened last night. They're just coming back in the top of the ninth to win that game. This group, just with the bats and how they played and everything else, there was never a moment where I said, yeah, there's no way they can win this game. I've never said that in the entire season. And that moment was kind of pervasive last night. Even when Davis hit the homer, I think we all kind of, you know, muttered about Maddon and what was happening for about 30 seconds. But after that, it was like, well, we got Schwarber, Rizzo, and Bryant coming up. I mean, this is not over. I mean, we have this. So understanding that and that kind of being around all year, that's what made it really great.
So I'll admit, I never really got the Warriors blew the 3-1 lead jokes. Like, I never understood why that was funny. Do you find yourself with a newfound understanding of the humor in that this morning?
No, because I don't take any enjoyment in Indians fans losing in that fashion. I feel incredibly bad for them. The city of Cleveland isn't one collective group of people. Like, there are people who like the Cavs, people who like the Indians, and I'm sure there are separate groups in there. And I can't imagine what it would have been like to blow that. So I'm taking no enjoyment in their pain. I'm just taking enjoyment in my own happiness.
Well, we are thrilled that you get to experience this. I can only imagine. I mean, just for us, it was one of the most enjoyable game watching experiences we've ever had. So with a stake in it, I don't know whether it would have been new ulcers. Yeah, I don't know whether, I mean, were you having fun? Were you enjoying that? Or were you just so anxious that you couldn't until it was all over?
It was fun. I mean, it was fun. And Sunday was fun, you know, just and Wednesday and Tuesday was fun. You know, like watching Arrieta come out and deal like that in the way that he could, and watching Lester do the same, watching Lester do it last night. Yes, there were definitely moments of enjoyment along the way. Not even the most dreadful, like, fatalistic Cubs fan in the world could have not pulled moments of joy out of that.
I applaud you for what seems like a really healthy relationship with baseball, which I would know nothing about at this point.
Well, you know, it's hard not to have a healthy relationship with baseball when you're 6 hours or so removed from your team winning the World Series.
I guess that's true.
Yeah. All right. Well, after the game, Theo said we don't need a plane to fly home, but I guess you do need a plane to get to L.A. and you're about to board one. So we will let you go. We appreciate it and congratulations.
Appreciate it, guys. Cubs won the World Series. I'll talk to you guys soon.
All right. See you. I could sense the excitement. Could you sense his excitement?
Yeah, I don't think I needed. I could hear his excitement.
Yeah. So good. I'm glad we got the Cubs fan perspective, and now we can get the perspective of the two of us who are supposed to be impartial and disinterested observers of this game and did not really have a rooting interest other than what best suited our story at any particular time. And still, we were really just blown away by this game. If you could all just see the transcript of the Ringer's MLB Slack channel, which seemed to have more people in it than it ever has before.
Yeah, and there were people in that channel last night. I don't know.
Right. And it just devolved into messages about several people being typing at the same time and exclamations after every incredible twist and turn. So we're just going to draft some of our favorite moments from that game and see where it takes us. So do you want to start?
I think the first pick is obvious, and I had the first pick in the last draft, so I'll let you choose.
Go. Okay. You go.
All right, I'm going to go with the Rajay Davis home run.
Okay, yeah.
Because, so I have made a point, you know, Andy McCullough, who is an excellent beat writer for the LA Times, has this habit of tweeting about 4 minutes ahead of the action on TV. So in key moments, I've taken to closing my Twitter timeline in key at bats so nothing gets spoiled. But for whatever reason, maybe because I didn't think that Rajay Davis was going to literally hit a home run, I just started seeing holy shit, holy shit, holy shit about 40 times before it actually happened. And everything from the moment to, and I think everybody, whether the Cubs were going to win or lose, didn't want to see Aroldis Chapman on the mound.
Yeah.
We can just not talk about specifics of that right now, but I think there are a lot of people who might even have been pulling for the Cubs in general who were rooting for him to blow that save, and you know, right, everything from that to, you know, actually hitting the camera to, you know, it was just, and Randy wrote an article last year about the 10 or the 15 biggest plays in baseball history, mm-hmm, by championship win probability. And this one wound up being number 3. So everything from the moment to the stakes to that, you know, we were all sort of waiting for that one last Cleveland counterpunch. I mean, that's an all-time great baseball moment right there.
Yeah, it was amazing. And for it to be Davis, who had screwed up in the outfield early on and had contributed to Cubs runs, and who is just a speedster in general and had not hit a home run since August. So he is not the guy that you would expect to do that. And it really just, at that point, you kind of wrote the Indians off. And I think our editor, or your former editor, Mallory Rubin, had already pronounced the Cubs the victors in MLB Slack.
I think that was a reverse jinx.
Quite a bit of confidence.
I don't think she actually believed that.
Maybe. I don't know. But there were definitely times where it seemed over. And when Chapman came in with a substantial lead, that was one of them. So, yeah, that's about as good as it got in that game. So I'm trying to think of where I would go next. I might go David Ross. I guess I'd take the David Ross home run. And the fact that it came off Andrew Miller, and obviously that it came in David Ross's final game and all of the mystique surrounding that, but the fact that the Cubs hit Miller, and maybe I'm drafting too many things at once here. But
no, we can talk about all this at once.
Yeah, I mean, this entire postseason was about relievers being used in unorthodox ways and being used more than they ever were in the regular season. And we wondered, and I think we talked on this show possibly about how long teams could keep that up and whether there was sort of an expiration date, given that these players were not conditioned to pitch like this. And in October, there was no wall that they ran into. They were doing just fine. And we saw, you know, one indication of mortality from Miller when he was being used the other night with a big lead. And who knows whether it was because it was a big lead or whether because he was tiring, he finally gave up a run. But in this one, he looked more mortal than he had. And of course, so did Chapman. So all postseason, I feel like this was building, right? We were wondering, when were these guys going to get gassed? And it turns out that the moment was Game 7, just
all
in
them,
time
all
for...
All at once, too.
Yeah, right. All at once. Miller, Chapman, all at once it happened, and it happened just in time for incredible comebacks to occur. So I think that is great that we got to see these guys used in the way that we have been pushing for them to be used for forever. But when it came down to Game 7, the concern that we had about the series early on, that if one team got ahead, that would be it and it would kill the suspense because the bullpens were so good, that was not an issue in Game 7.
Yeah, I in the 5 minutes from when we decided we were going to do this to when we actually started doing this, I just wrote down a list. And one of them is, one of the things on my list is just Andrew Miller, oh no, it's not working.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I actually, like, I had FS1 in the background while I was writing, and they showed the highlights of the David Ross home run and the, they call it dick bump, I think was,
yeah.
Yeah. And I just was like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. That happened today.
And, the other great thing about the Fox broadcast and the David Ross home run was where Joe Buck goes and we have Ross mic'd up and here's the sounds of the game. And here's how David Ross celebrated his home run. And then they play the audio.
Yeah.
It's just him going, ugh, and then running silently around the bases. And then Buck just having to be like, there were no words.
Yeah.
I don't know whether
I hate my producer.
I know, right? Didn't someone listen to that before they threw it to Buck?
I know. Anyway. I kept waiting. Yeah. Okay. So my next pick is also David Ross related, and that's the wild pitch doink off his helmet.
Which, yeah.
Like, I think that might have been another moment where in the Slack, everybody was like, have you seen anything like that before? And no is the answer to that question.
No, for two runs to score on a wild pitch off a catcher's helmet, essentially, that was weird.
Yeah, and that was another sneaky storyline was Kipnis's ankle injury that just kept showing up all over. You know, he was just a half step slow to balls in the field, you know, running out grounders, you know, not really putting pressure on the Cubs on the bases. And, you know, he's not Billy Hamilton anyway, but he runs pretty well ordinarily, but he's just been, you know, and that, the Schwarber single in the 10th, like if Kipnis is healthy, maybe he gets a quicker first step and tracks that down. But, you know, that was just all being heads up in that moment. And yeah, and there's something to watching grown men wearing a lot of padding just fall down on their butt. Uh-huh. And I think this is why I like, part of the reason I like hockey so much. But, it, you know, we got a great moment like that with Ross just getting his feet tangled up, which is, I'm glad that's what it was and not he took the ball off the forehead and his brain was rattling around inside his skull.
Yeah, I might be overreaching with this pick again, but I think I'll just take the fact that this game was extremely sloppy. It was just so poorly played for much of the early innings, at least. I mean, there were four errors in this game. There was the wild pitch that we just talked about. There was a pickoff. There were plays that weren't errors that still were subpar defensive plays, like Davis getting a really lousy jump on a fly ball. And so, I mean, this was kind of baseball's marquee game. It was the climax of the whole season. There were the highest stakes possible, and it looked like it was getting to guys. And it's, you know, it's hard to say how much of it was the adrenaline and the nerves and how much of it was just people making errors. That happens in low stakes games too. But it did seem as if at times both sides were kind of overcome by this or pressing a little bit or definitely feeling the nerves. And, you know, you got a window into that when they showed the clip of Rizzo and Ross talking in the dugout and Rizzo just being a mess. And that was that was like 10 plot twists away from the end of the game. And, and he was already feeling that. So I liked that the players seemed to be affected by the atmosphere in the way that one might expect them to be. And so this was just a very sloppy game early on, and that in no way impaired our enjoyment of the game, because it doesn't really matter if it's a crisply played game if both teams are making mistakes, and that is contributing to a really close and exciting game. It doesn't matter if that's sort of the poster game for how baseball is supposed to be played or not.
Yeah, I think I was sort of relieved that it was a little sloppy, because I think Major League Baseball has a little bit of the NFL problem where it's so good, like the quality is so good that it gets boring a little bit from time to time. But yeah, we were rescued from that for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I'm going to go quick because there are a bunch of things I want to get to. One of which is Aroldis Chapman's declining velocity.
Yeah.
The headline that went up on my story about whether Joe Maddon had made a mistake by using Chapman in game six, I think was a little bit stronger than a little bit stronger of a take than the one that was actually contained within the article. So like, I didn't expect it to actually come back to bite them. You know, I thought that it was a possibility and it was greater than the chance that Travis Wood would have blown a 5-run lead, but I wouldn't have given it more than a 1 in 5 chance of actually happening. And then he comes in and he's not only gassing in a way where he's like having trouble hitting his spots, like the velocity's actually down too. And just being able to, if it wasn't literally the Davis home run, you could see something else coming. And I thought that was just a really cool collective oh shit moment.
Yeah, I think he threw something like 34% sliders, which is high for him. And he was, you know, hanging some of them too. And I think he only touched triple digits once and only just barely. He hit 100.3. So for most pitchers, that would be extremely impressive. But for him, that is low velo. And you would expect him in World Series Game 7 to be throwing harder than usual, if anything. So the fact that it was down that significantly really does go to show that, yeah, maybe using him in that Game 6 was not the best idea, and just as it seemed to most people at the time. All right, so while we're on the subject of Chapman, I guess I will take Chapman too. So I had tweeted something early on in the game about, you know, when it seemed like the Cubs were going to win, I just kind of wanted them to score enough runs that Chapman wouldn't be the one on the mound, because, you know, obviously with the suspension under the domestic violence policy, I don't know whether it tainted the season for Cubs fans that they acquired him, but it made them a little less of a purely enjoyable story for outsiders, you know, when they were just kind of a homegrown team that developed and drafted all their own players or managed to trade for undervalued commodities from other teams. It was very easy to root for them if you weren't being beaten by them. But for Chapman to come over at midseason and just kind of be this outsider picked up for the stretch run and to come with the baggage he came with, and for the Cubs to basically decide, well, it didn't matter what he did off the field. They just wanted to win a World Series and they were going to do it with Aroldis Chapman. That made you feel maybe a little bit more ambivalent about the way they were going about this. And so I kind of just didn't want Chapman to be the one on the mound when this drought was finally broken. And some people I know thought that he should be, that, you know, the Cubs made this morally questionable decision and they should be forced to live with that and suffer the consequences of that in this great moment for their franchise. The guy on the mound would be Aroldis Chapman. But just for the larger enjoyment of baseball fans as a whole, this is a highlight that we are going to be seeing for decades, centuries, the last out of the Cubs World Series. And so I thought it would be kind of nice if someone else was on the mound. I was sort of rooting for John Lester, maybe to stay out there and get through the whole game, or either that or for the Cubs to somehow score enough runs that they didn't need a closer. And that would have needed to be a ton of runs based on
I don't know.
Madden's usage of Chapman in game six.
When you said that, I was like, I don't know that I can count high enough that they wouldn't use him.
Yeah, right. So As it worked out, Chapman got into the game, but by win probability added, was actually the worst Cub in this game. He contributed the most toward a Cubs loss. So he got hit. He didn't look good. He blew the save, and the Cubs still won. And I know that technically he is the winning pitcher. He was the pitcher of record, but he was bad. He did nothing to help the Cubs win in this game. And so if you didn't want Chapman to be the hero of the Game 7 that we had all been waiting for, then we got that. And he even kind of got a comeuppance in a sense. So it was a little less complicated to celebrate at the end.
Yeah, I actually don't know that it made it any less complicated for me, but I also have, in recent years, I've become extremely wary of, like, saying this team deserves or doesn't deserve. And I know that's not actually what you're saying, but
yeah,
this team deserves or doesn't deserve because of, you know, they've got good people on it or whatever, you know, because almost there was a moment a few weeks ago where, it was, the Temple Penn State game. And, you know, I went to Temple and, know a bunch of people who went there, and like that, you know, there's an obvious banter in that college football rivalry right now. And it just sort of made me feel icky to use, you know, a real heinous real world situation to, you know, as sports banter. And so that, you know, there's, by saying that it's better that Aroldis Chapman wasn't on the mound, so we didn't have to think about it at that moment. Like, on one level, I agree, but on another level, it's weird. And
yeah, I don't think it makes the action of trading for him any different. But I guess just the, you know, the fact that we can watch the highlight and not have to be reminded that it was Aroldis Chapman every time that we see it in perpetuity.
I guess that makes me one of the people who thinks that, you know, if they did this, he should have been on the mound. But okay, so my next pick is on the opposite of that in terms of levity. I'm gonna go with drunk Theo Epstein. And I was watching again, you know, he was talking to Bill Murray in the Cubs locker room, and I was thinking, like, I guess it's been like an hour since the game ended, but I don't think I've ever gotten, like, he was slurring his speech.
Yeah, and he was cursing, like, on live TV.
I don't think that I've ever gotten that drunk that fast.
Because he was sitting with his son during the game, and all the times they showed him, it didn't look like he was drinking during the game. So he must have really crammed that into a compressed period.
I guess if you're like, I can't imagine how nervous he was, you know, throughout Game 7, and then you just pound a bottle and a half of champagne immediately. That was just, I mean, that was amazing. And then obviously his I don't know what you want to call his reign of terror as the night went on. He's bouncing from champagne to TV interview and you know, abdicating responsibility to Jed Hoyer while he goes on a bender. It was one of the highlights of the night for me.
Yeah, and I think in a similar vein, I will take Chris Bryant's expression during the final play as he fielded that ball, which was just amazing. You know, you could see him realizing the comprehension was dawning that they were going to get out of this jam, and all he had to do to end this 100 years of suffering was field a ball and make a throw to first base, something that he has done many, many times in his life. And so he, I guess, had the presence of mind to appreciate it as it was happening. And he's just beaming, and the slow motion replay is great as he is seeing the ball come to him, and just the smile is growing as he fields it and transfers it. And that was really nice, because you usually see the smiles and the joy come out in the dog pile and in the moments after the game, but for it actually to creep into the game itself was really nice to see.
Yeah, I'm going to pick the other half of that, and that is that Michael Martinez made the last out.
Of all the improbable, unpredictable parts of this game.
I mean, that's not unpredictable at all. Michael Martinez was the utility man for the Phillies when I was still writing for Crash Burn Alley. I think the single meanest thing I've ever written about an athlete was at Crash Burn about Michael Martinez. There was just because, you know, I follow a lot of Philly people on Twitter, there was a collective, oh my God, not this guy. Like, I didn't get a text from my friends from back home all night until Michael Martinez entered the game. And yeah, I didn't realize how bad this was, but this showed up in my recap too. He has the fourth worst OPS plus ever among position players with 500 or more plate appearances. And yet, like, this game was so loony that I thought that he was going to, I thought, like, you know, of course he's going to get the game tying double or something like that. And when the ball squirted out, like, I was thinking, oh, you know, is he going to beat this out? And they flip over to first base and he's 40 feet from the bag. And I'm like, no, because he's slow and he sucks and there's no way he's going to beat this out. So
yeah,
that was just a personal emotional roller coaster for me.
Yeah. All right. I think I will take the Dexter Fowler leadoff homer, which is easy to overlook because it happened about 4.5 hours before the game ended. And there was just so much baseball crammed into the intervening 10 innings. But for him to do that and just show that Corey Kluber was hittable, which is not something we had seen all October. He had had an incredible run and he'd been great in this series. And we all thought, I think the Cubs were favored by bookies in this game, but I think by statistical models, the Indians were the favorites.
Very slight favorites.
Yeah. I mean, they were at home and they had Kluber going and you knew that they were only going to use Kluber and Miller and Allen if they were anywhere close to winning this game and it didn't go into extra innings. And for Kluber to give up a run immediately just gave you the sense that, oh, okay, this is not over. The Indians are not just going to run wild over the Cubs and the Cubs have a real shot here and these guys can be beaten. And it was great that in order to win, in order to put all of the curse conversation behind them, they had to beat Kluber and Miller and Allen, who have basically been the final bosses of October all month long. And into November, they were the guys that no one wanted to face, that no one was able to hit. And here they were hitting him. And Kluber never even got a strikeout right in the game. Nah. He wasn't missing bats.
Yeah, I think he got like one or two whiffs the entire night.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, he evidently finally reached the end of his rope too. And that was a storyline we were watching. Obviously, we know that aces pitching on short rest in the postseason are not themselves normally, but in his second start in this series, he seemed really none the worse for wear. So for him to finally show some signs of fatigue showed the humanity of these guys that the Indians had really had ridden for more than half of their playoff innings, which was just a desperation tactic that they really had to employ.
Yeah. I'm going to go a little bit off the board with my next one.
All right.
You know, we talked about storylines from this postseason and, you know, whether it's Kyle Hendricks showing up in a big way or Kluber or the Indians bullpen management. For me, the biggest storyline of this postseason is that I discovered that Brandon Guyer is one of my probably five favorite players in Major League Baseball right now. And he went 2-for-2 with a walk and was instrumental in pretty much every Indians comeback from the moment he entered the game. And I'm thinking they're keep, you know, I guess if they're just going to go to the wall with Lester and Chapman, that's one thing, but he keeps facing lefties and the double right before the Davis home run. I was not emotionally prepared for him to make the last out, but he walked and scored on the Rajay Davis single. So this is a big night for Brandon Guyer. And as the internet's leading Brandon Guyer fan, it was a big night for me as well.
Yeah. You called a home run in.
I've done that every
Brandon
time he's
Guyer
come up against
appearance.
A lefty. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to take the rain delay, which at the time seemed like a potential disaster.
God, I thought this was 2008 all over again. Because I mean, the radar thing they kept showing, I guess I just had no concept of how fast weather moves.
Yeah.
But, like, there was that big scary orange thing that I come to think of it was like all the way over Illinois, which is a long way away. But
yeah. And I mean, so much had happened to that point. And I think as things stood at that moment, the win expectancies for both teams were tied at exactly 50%. And for it to be placed on hold there just while the heavens opened up just seemed like a disaster, but also seemed incredibly appropriate. And everyone got to make jokes about how this game was never, ever going to end. And it was going to be a never ending rain delay. And we were all going to just be waiting forever because the universe wouldn't allow one of these teams to win. So the fact that that happened and that it was crazy and and yet it only lasted for 17 minutes. So we didn't actually have to watch a drawn out rain delay, and it didn't seem to affect play at all. It just added to the craziness without really subtracting anything.
Yeah, I was really worried that it was just the conditions were going to turn to shit at that moment. And that would that would have been a huge bummer if like this game was decided because Cody Allen lost the grip on his curveball because it was wet. So if nothing else, I'm glad it happened and was brief.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with Javi Baez's ill-fated two-strike squeeze bunt.
Yeah. That's a great one.
Which I think it all happened so quickly. I don't even remember when it was, but they just put the bunt sign on with two strikes. And I'm like, it was just a universal, what the fuck are you doing, Joe Madden moment.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you can kind of see how it might make sense to squeeze there, especially with a guy who'd had a rough series, although he had homered earlier in the game, which was a pretty cool moment on its own.
What's he going to do? Strike out anyway. So
I mean, with two strikes, it was very surprising, and he did not execute, and he screamed in frustration, and the whole thing was just really came as a shock. And who was it? Hayward was on third, so the Cubs were very close to scoring the go-ahead run, and for that at bat to end in an extremely unexpected way, I agree, that was great. I think I will take Kyle Schwarber reaching on an infield single and then stealing a base in
I had completely forgotten that happened.
It's hard to remember all of the twists and turns that this game took, but I mean, that was, I think, the first clear indication that things were going to get weird. If Schwarber was going to get on with an infield single and then steal a base, which is not his strength, and we saw later in the game he had a two-twin.
Oh, he was feeling himself. Oh, yeah, man, that was great.
He was thrown out trying to stretch not even coming close to stretching a single into a double, so that is Kyle Schwarber as a base runner, and yet we got to see him showcase his speed in this game, which was just another thing that is almost lost in the madness that followed it, but was great at the time.
All right, I'm going to go with Kyle Hendricks' stiff upper lip, which it started like you could not have picked a set of starting pitchers who were less visibly excited to be pitching in game 7. And I think Kluber is just sort of like that. Uh-huh. And, Hendricks, I interviewed him for that story back in September, and, he's talks like a perfect, well, he doesn't talk like a normal guy. He talks like his voice is going through a bass pedal. He's got the freakish deep voice, but he's, like a normal dude. And he goes to the mound, and he's got this weird, Michael Cera in Arrested Development walking around to the Charlie Brown music gate to him, and he just completely emotionless on the mound. It was like it started freaking me out a little bit. So when when Miller and Lester come in and they start jumping around and pumping their fists when they get out of innings, like it was just a welcome reminder that I was still alive.
Right. Yeah, that's my next pick, actually. John Lester's relief appearance and John Lester's emotion, because I think just in general, great starting pitchers coming in out of the bullpen is one of my favorite things about the playoffs. When we were tentatively planning to do a draft of favorite playoff moments before this game happened, I think Clayton Kershaw coming in game 5 of the NLCS to seal that win was going to be my favorite moment, and maybe still is my favorite individual moment of this postseason, because the starter coming in, the ace coming in out of the bullpen, that's just the clearest indication that, okay, this is not regular season baseball anymore. This is something different. And so for Lester to come in, and for him after some of his big outs to just do some really raunchy celebrations and just be fist pumping and screaming, and especially, yes, as you mentioned, the contrast to the actual starting pitchers in the game, that was pretty special.
Yeah, it's how you're in an early 90s baseball movie, because it happens in little big league and major league. Do you see his post game interview at all?
No.
I think it was Verducci just goes and says something like, you guys are, just won the World Series. And he's just like, yeah, how about that? And he just went on and tried to talk. He was like, yeah, I've just got He said he was not happy about having to come in from the bullpen. But yeah, that was really cool for a guy who's been there a couple times to still get to him like that.
Yeah.
Okay. I am going to go with Jose Ramirez getting picked off first base.
Okay.
Just because the Indians continued, like, they just gave away outs on the bases in buckets, which was frustrating as someone who is a fan of aggressive base running.
Uh-huh.
Francisco Lindor doing it in particular. And after, I think it was game five when he got picked off on the way back out to center field, Rajay Davis, like, stopped at second base to talk to Lindor for like 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. What I presume was just like, dude, you got to knock that off. And when Ramirez got picked off, I just imagined Davis standing on the top step of the dugout, like looking like the disappointed school teacher. Like, you know, you guys have gotta stop giving away outs.
Yeah, I think I'll take the opposite of that too. And I will take the Cubs good base running in two particular instances. In the fourth, after Bryant had gotten on a single and then advanced on a hit by pitch to Anthony Rizzo, of course, and got over to third on a ground out, and then he scored on the sac fly to Rajay Davis, who seemed not to treat the situation with the urgency it deserved. He kind of didn't really settle himself to throw, and it took him a little while to get the ball out of his glove. And so Bryant just, it was one of the shallower sac flies that you'll see a non-elite runner score on or try to score on, and to see him try and to see him make it, that was fun. Also, in the 10th inning, when Schwarber had led off with a single, and then Chris Bryant hit a ball to the warning track that looked like it might be out for a moment, and it wasn't, but then Albert Almora tagged. He was running for Schwarber, and he tagged and went from first to second, which is one of my favorite plays, I think, just because it's pretty rare to see that, because obviously it's a shorter throw to second from the outfield, so you don't often see the guy on first tag and go to second. But that ball was hit so deep, and Davis had to go back on it, and so he wasn't in a great position to throw. And for him to take that base at a time when every base was crucial and it was a tie game and it looked like that might be the difference, that was pretty exemplary. So I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say Bryant scoring for first on that. Anthony, wow, that was scored a single, Anthony Rizzo's hit. Uh-huh. Yeah. In the fifth inning. I mean, and Fox went back and did the thing where they, you know, did the family circus tracing, you know, right around the bases. Yeah. But that was another good piece of base running by Bryant.
Yeah, that was good, too.
Just one. Now, we talked about it. It was the Kipnis foul ball that everybody thought was out.
Yes.
But yeah, we talked about that already.
Yeah, Mays brought that up. But that camera angle was like the last out of the 2000 World Series when Mike Piazza hit a high fly ball to center and seemed like it was way over the fence. And then suddenly the camera pulls down and Bernie Williams is settling under it somehow. Yeah, it was very much like that. So, all right, I think we could probably rack our brains and keep going. I don't think we have exhausted all of this game's intricacies, but
I'd have to go back and watch it again.
Yeah, I know. we will stop there. And I enjoyed the, I don't know whether to call it symmetry or asymmetry or what, but just the way that this postseason was bookended by, in the first game, a manager not using his closer, which we all still can't believe that Zach Britton was not in the AL wildcard game. And then for it to come down to, in the final game, maybe two managers, but certainly one, overusing his closer, and that being as controversial a move as not using a closer was, it kind of showed just how much bullpen usage evolved over the course of this month, essentially, where in the beginning, we're in this sort of traditionalist old school mindset where you're not going to use your closer in the tie game on the road. And then by the end of it, the tactic of using your closer at high leverage moments had so much success that suddenly managers were overusing these guys and bringing them in when they didn't actually need them. And it almost came back to bite the Cubs. So I enjoyed the, I don't know, the symbolism of that.
Can't predict baseball.
No, there were so many things to love about this game and about this postseason as a whole. So we are lucky that it ended this way, I think. And I enjoyed talking about it with you throughout, and we are not ending. As we mentioned on our last episode, this podcast is continuing into the off season. We won't have as good material to work with as the Cubs and Indians gave us last night, but we'll be talking about hot stove stuff. We'll be talking to players. The off season is a bit of a slower time, so yeah. You get a chance to actually have conversations with these guys and ask them about how they did what they did. So hopefully we'll have some cool conversations coming up, but we'll be every Monday from here on out, probably.
Yeah.
All right. So that is it. Great season. Good start to the podcast. Good talking to you.
My pleasure.
And we will be back soon.